The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
What do you make of the regional banks right now? Like, how bad is it going to get?
The panacea of the Treasury announcing that all deposits are federally insured doesn't solve this problem. And I don't say this lightly,
okay.
But in 1934, the Federal Reserve Act confiscated gold from US citizens. We're at the point where the Fed and the Treasury officials, I'm sure, are having to consider a gate, a lock on US bank deposits. Let me tell you why.
Wait. Does that mean that you're looking for, we're gonna confiscate all the gold, or there's gonna be universal deposit insurance, or we're gonna stop, what does that mean?
A bank is like a hedge fund, okay? And hedge funds, they put a gate, which is, say, when you want your money back, they go, we'll call you, yeah? Mm. If you're in one of these big, huge, super hedge funds, it can take you 2 years to get the money out. And of course, what we discovered with the iPhone, with the banks, the deposits instantly come out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The money is coming out because CDs, banking CDs, were priced at 10 basis points, and the Fed's giving you 500 basis points. And hard-pressed folk are like, yeah, you know what? Boom, money market mutual fund.
Don't we just solve this problem by cutting rates? Then that isn't a problem anymore.
That's what was so off about yesterday. That Jay and the Fed actually aggravated the problem further. They're like, why don't we hike 25 more? Why don't we encourage more deposit flight from the regional banks? It's like, hello, is anyone in?
Hold on a second. If they hadn't done anything and they had said, you know what, we're going to hold tight because the regional banks are having a problem, and they didn't do anything, everyone would have panicked anyway.
Hey, sometimes it's kind of relevant to panic. I would recommend you panic. What I would recommend is transparency and honesty. You know what, folks, I'm speaking to you on behalf of the Federal Reserve. We got a little bit carried away. We raised rates with a magnitude and a rapidity which we regret. We've come to understand that with the profound leverage within our system, that taking rates to 5.25% when debt, I'm approximating, but it's four times the size of the economy, and now things are breaking, and therefore, I apologize, and we're going to bring them down. The good news is, owing to how I kind of messed up, we're probably going to be looking at deflationary prices next year. So my promise to you is we're going back to ZERP.
Okay, so when do we get back to zero?
Well, clearly after yesterday, the Fed's not going to volunteer, okay? And so we adults are going to have to break more things until they recognize it.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The major indexes finished out the week on a negative note despite strong gains on Friday. The exception was the NASDAQ that ended the week with a slight gain helped by strong earnings coming in from Apple. As expected, the Fed raised another quarter of a point, its 10th consecutive increase, hinting they were close to a pause. But trouble remains in the banking industry. Regional bank indexes continued to plunge as fears grow over the solvency of many of the nation's banks. Even the big banks were getting hit, from Bank of America to Wells Fargo to brokerage firms like Charles Schwab, which has lost 42% since the banking crisis emerged with the failure of Silicon Valley Bank. Well, the rally on Friday was triggered by a stronger-than-expected jobs report, but a bit of caution here. The job numbers from previous months have all been revised at much lower numbers. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up, Mark Chandler and I will discuss the fate of the U.S. dollar, the Fed rate-raising cycle, and why Mark is still cautious. Chris Poplava and Chris Sheridan will follow Mark with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's find out the events moving the markets this week with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Wall Street experienced another volatile week as a result of three catalysts plaguing stocks. And they have been for some time. And that would be rate hikes, volatility in bank stocks, and a softening economic outlook. At the start of the week, JPMorgan Chase acquired the majority of assets, deposits, and liabilities of First Republic Bank, marking it as the third bank to fail since February. PacWest and Western Alliance saw significant losses through the week's trading. On one day in particular, PacWest experienced a 50% drop on Thursday after confirming their search for a strategic change. Western Alliance suffered a 28.5% drop following a Financial Times story that Western Alliance also was seeking alternatives, including a possible sale. But Western Alliance denied the story's accuracy, calling it categorically false in all respects. Both stocks rebounded strongly on Friday with the market rally, with PacWest up 81% and Western Alliance up 49%. Despite the rally, both stocks still had high double-digit losses compared to the previous week's Friday, and industry represented in the ETF KRE was down 10% for the week. Worries continue to mount over central banks' tightening conditions in the face of banking issues as the Hong Kong Monetary Authority, the Norges Bank, and the ECB, the European Central Bank, all raised their key lending rates 25 basis points, all following the Fed's rate hike on Wednesday, also 25 basis points. The rate hike was largely expected. They removed a phrase from the March policy statement that additional policy increases might be appropriate, and instead, they said that they would monitor economic and financial market developments and the effects of earlier hikes to see if more policy firming would be appropriate to move towards the 2% inflation over time. While the Fed may pause, it is not looking to cut rates anytime soon, with Powell adding, if the inflation forecast from the Fed officials is broadly right, it would not be appropriate to cut rates. This flies in stark contrast to the Fed futures, which are currently predicting around 3 rate cuts by year end. Powell also stated that it's not possible to say the Fed has reached a sufficient level with confidence and that the banking issues have complicated their tasks. But for the bull side, Powell did say he thought the Fed is closer to the end of a tightening cycle than the beginning, and that he still believes a soft landing is possible. But the Fed is still data dependent and hasn't made up its mind whether it's done raising rates. So again, meeting went as well as it could. I'd say he even threaded the needle as best he could, but it just shows the Fed funds futures thoughts are pretty far away from the Fed's thoughts, with a unanimous decision across the FOMC to raise rates, followed by several other central banks raising rates this week. On the economic side, there were too many reports to go over, but the key ones were the ISM figures for April. The manufacturing index lifted somewhat in April to 47.1 from 46.3, still in contraction territory. The ISM non-manufacturing index, so services, also increased to 51.9 from 51.2. Now, any reading below 50 is contraction. Any reading above is expansion. So respondents were positive about conditions in services, while also mentioning inflation and economic slowdown concerns are still there. China's official manufacturing PMI fell back into contraction territory in April at 49.2, and the Eurozone manufacturing PMI for April was also weaker than March, but neither report seemed to weigh on stocks this week. A slew of employment data hit the news this week, starting off with the job openings report, also known as the JOLTS, which showed openings shrunk to 9.59 million from 9.97 million in February. The ADP private payroll showed an increase of 296,000, which was well received. The most important employment figure was on Friday's release of the non-farm payrolls, which showed growth of 253,000 in April above consensus. March data was revised lower, which has been a recent trend, down to 165,000 from 236,000. So it does lay some concern over the numbers we get live at the beginning of the month. The unemployment rate fell to 3.4%. The average work week was unchanged, and the average hourly earnings increased to 0.5% up from up only 0.3% previously. While there has been some softening in the labor market, the overall strength, despite the most restrictive financial conditions since the 1970s, gives many the justification needed to say a soft landing is still on track. When you combine the stable jobs report with Apple's earnings and the reaction in the stock it received to an increase in dividends and an additional program to repurchase $90 billion in stock, it led to the rally that finished the week on a strong note. But due to the reaction to bank stocks and a tighter monetary policy, the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials still finished the week down 0.8% for the S&P, down 1.2% for the Dow. The NASDAQ, with the help of the tech stocks and, of course, Apple, which came to the rescue on Friday, the NASDAQ was up 0.7% for the week. So again, yet another week with rates, banking, and the labor market at the center of it all. Up next, Mark Chandler, Chief Market Strategist from Bannock Burn, Global Forex, to give his macro outlook.
Investors always need to know what is the big picture that is driving the world economy, the world geopolitics, the decisions of central bankers and big corporations. They need to know what that is. Otherwise, they can be easily lost in the daily news, the Fed, the talk. And I think it is very clear that over the last 2 years, the biggest single factor driving that big picture or shaping that big picture is this moment when the BRICS are overtaking the G7 nations.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At a time, bank deposits offer very low interest and could be at risk. Corporate cash accounts are also progressively losing ground to inflation. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we offer a solution to this problem. Our firm specializes in assisting companies by managing cash balances with short-term treasuries and high-quality corporate bonds that may provide higher interest rates. This approach not only helps to manage your corporate cash balances with competitive yields, but also to help reduce taxes through the use of treasury securities, which are exempt from state and local income taxes. Give us a call today at 888-486-3939 to find out how we can assist you to earn higher interest rates with no bank risk and no state and local income taxes. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, since reaching a peak last year, the dollar has been in decline. Does it stabilize here? Does it go further? Let's find out. Joining us on the program is Mark Chandler. He's chief market strategist at Bannockburn Forex. Mark, let's begin with the dollar. We've seen Russia, China, and some of the BRIC countries are moving out of the dollar in oil trades. Some countries in Africa are now trading in oil with gold. What's your take on the dollar? Is it in the process of losing its status, or are we going to go to more of a multi-currency world, in your opinion?
Sure. Thanks, Jim. I think that I make two distinctions here between like the price of the dollar now, how it's trading in the foreign exchange market. And like you said, it looks like dollar peaked last year, September, October. And then there's this bigger question that I think is really like what everybody wants to talk about, and that's the future of the dollar. And like you mentioned, there's been a lot more, it seems like there's been a lot more transactions conducted in other currencies besides the dollar. But I wonder, so I begin off with distinguishing between two parts of the dollar's role in the world economy. One is a transactional vehicle. Like you say, oil is priced in dollars, often traded in dollars. Most commodities are priced and traded in dollars. So when China buys iron ore from Australia, it's not only priced in dollars, but it's probably invoiced in U.S. dollars as well. Same thing when Brazil sells soybeans to China. Dollars has been the traditional trade vehicle. But there's been several changes, including technological changes with payment systems, making it easier to transact in another currency besides the dollar. Brazil and India, for example, have very advanced, sophisticated payment systems. So does China in a way. But what these payment systems have in common is they're only good for their currency, Indian rupee, Chinese RMB, Brazilian real. They're not sewn together into a global payment system, messaging system like SWIFT. But it's true that the dollar's role, I mean, it seems reasonable to expect that over time, as a transactional vehicle, the dollar will lose some of its role. Countries want to trade in their own currencies. And like I say, the technology makes it possible. And the third factor are the sanctions. The U.S., since 9/11, the U.S. has really weaponized access to the dollar and to the U.S. capital markets in a way, I think, that scares people. And I think that the people who are leaving the dollar, and that's the way it's sort of portrayed it in the media, Russia left, Iran left, Venezuela left, but I don't really see them leaving. I see them being kicked out. And so the U.S., I think, chose or is choosing to exclude some parts of the world from access to the dollar. China, which wants to increase its own presence on the international stage, increase the use of the RMB, is being able to move into that vacuum created by purposeful U.S. action. That's the transactional role for the dollar. There is some, again, I make that distinction between the dollar's transactional use and its store of value. And that store of value is why many countries, including China, hold a large part of their reserves in U.S. dollars. You know, people talk about the exorbitant privilege of the dollar's role as this vehicle for savings, but the U.S. pays a higher interest rate than Europe, than China, than Japan. And so a country, when a country uses its surplus savings and buys U.S. treasuries or agency bonds, I think it's because of the depth, transparency of the U.S. treasury market. And I think that that's not going to be replaced, because part of the problem is that these countries that have large current account surpluses have also underdeveloped their capital markets, where they can't hold their own savings. They've got to export their savings somewhere. And the U.S. is the biggest market to hold on to those global savings. Other countries don't really want to do that.
You know, you bring up a good point, because you take a look at some of these corporations like Apple and some of those others that are sitting on $200 billion in cash. Where do you keep that money? It's got to be the U.S. Treasury market, whether it's T-bills or T-notes. But you certainly aren't going to keep $200 billion in a bank.
Yeah, no, I think it's not just companies, but I think you're right. Like, it's sort of interesting, like Apple, with all this cash, they also issue foreign currency bonds. And this is partly a management, a debt management issue. And also borrowing in yen. I mean, we've seen stories about Warren Buffett talking about boosting his Japanese asset holdings. And he's talking about not buying the yen, but borrowing the yen, issuing yen-denominated bonds to raise that capital to then invest in Japanese stocks. My sense would be, who am I to say anything to Warren Buffett about how he should invest? When I look at the dollar-yen, I see that the yen is something like 45% undervalued. Rather than be borrowing the yen, I'd rather buy the yen, betting that over time, might take a few years, that the yen is going to appreciate against the dollar and return to something closer to fair value.
I want to turn our attention to one of the things that strengthened the dollar last year is probably one of the most aggressive Fed rate raising cycles I've seen in my lifetime. I mean, it's hard to believe that we went from zero to almost 5% in one full year. But one of the things that happens when they raise rates like that, something usually breaks. And right now we're seeing breaks in the banking system. I'd like to get your take on that. We just saw First J.P. Morgan take over First Republic. We had Silicon Valley Bank go under last month. And if you look at some of these bank indexes, it looks like, you know, the stocks fell off a cliff.
What you say is true. I think that Federal Reserve did raise rates aggressively. And like you say, probably the most aggressive that we've seen in our lifetime. And I think people generally took it that the Federal Reserve would only stop when something broke, and that what could break could be inflation could really fall sharply. But so far, it really hasn't. It's coming down. And we should expect further decline in inflation through this quarter. Second half will be tougher for comparison purposes. The other thing that could have broken was the labor market. And job growth is slowing. We see that also in the JOLTS report today. Fewer job openings. But the labor market still seems generally firm and better than it was at the end of 2019 before COVID. So the other thing that breaks, I think, in this kind of environment, if it's not going to be inflation, if it's not the labor market, it's the financial system. And I think many financial institutions found it difficult to manage the sharp rise in interest rates. The Fed stress test didn't really address that. And the way that we resolved the regulatory environment post the great financial crisis allowed banks to separate their holdings into two buckets, one that assets that were available for sale and one hold to maturity. So there's a lot of moving pieces here, but I think you're right that the regional banks have suffered and they're still under pressure. And the issue, I think, is how serious does it get? I think that a lot of people are looking at a repeat of the 2008-2009 financial crisis, and that's why the Fed funds futures market is pricing in about 75 basis points of cuts.
So we just recently talked to Bloomberg, and their economists have moved up their schedule for a recession. Where do you stand on a recession? Because things we're following looks like it's going to happen in the second half.
I'm sort of puzzled by a recession. You know, we had two quarters of negative growth. First two quarters of last year are negative growth. But I think most people, I mean, at the time, many people talked about a recession, but I think in hindsight, most people recognize that it really wasn't a recession. It was primarily inventories and trade, which were distorted for various reasons because of COVID and the uneven reopenings. So I'm not sure. I mean, to me, partly as a historian, I know that the whole concept of recession came about to avoid the word depression. It was too much like the 1930s. And, you know, if you think about the American, like the just the language, before the Great Depression, they were called depressions, panics, crises. Recession is a relatively new word, and there's not an agreed upon definition of it. Now, I look at things, probably some of the same things you're looking at, yield curves, the leading economic indicators, economic and financial variables that warn that the U.S. economy is slowing down. And we did see the economy slow to 1.1%. In Q1. But again, that was weighed down by inventories. And if you look at the underlying signal, and that we find that comes from what's called final sales to domestic parties. What that means is it excludes inventories, trade, and government spending. And by that measure, final sales to domestic parties rose. The economy expanded, that underlying signal expanded by about 2.9% in Q1. So what I find interesting, I think, is that economists, reluctant like everybody else, to admit that they're wrong. And so what they do is they just keep pushing out the date. So first, we're going to have the recession the first half of last year. Even though we contracted, the economy bounced back and people said, okay, the recession is going to come in the second half of the year. And now it's going to be, we obviously know it's not contracting yet. So now people keep pushing it off to some future date. I sort of think that there's some offsetting things that need to be taken into account too. One is that immigration, especially working age immigrants in the U.S., are back to almost where they were pre-COVID. Secondly, supply chain disruptions have eased. And thirdly, I think that we're still seeing a resilience of the U.S. consumer. There's more people working, getting paid a little bit more per hour, and that's turning into some reasonably good consumption figures. And so I'm concerned about the economy. I'm concerned that it's going to continue to slow, especially in the labor market. But I'm just not sure when the recession, whatever that really means, is going to take place. We should be aware of this, that a lot of data points to it. But so far, I'd say that it still looks, the U.S. economy still fairly resilient. And more than just that, but you know, the Europeans reported, the Eurozone reported a Q1 GDP last week as well. And they talked about 0.1% quarter over quarter. 0.1%, you annualize that, you're still talking about 0.5% of growth. And the other thing I would note, Jim, is that the Federal Reserve in December, the median Fed forecast for this year was 0.5% year over year. And in the March meeting, the summary of economic projections, the Fed shaved that to 0.4%. The Fed staff, like the Bloomberg economists, now think a recession is likely towards the end of this year. The Federal Reserve, I think, had been saying that since December. That's what 0.5% means. I mean, you think about that 1.1% growth in Q1, that almost meets alone the Fed's target for the whole year. So I think that we should expect a weaker economy under the weight of continued Fed tightening and the tightening of credit conditions. But I think it becomes really how we define a recession. And to me, the real issue is how deep and how long it lasts. And I think that many people, including the Fed, and the Bloomberg economists are talking about a relatively shallow and brief economic contraction.
And Mark, how much of all this federal spending, I think the Biden administration pushed through about $7.5 trillion, whether it's, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act or a different version of the Green New Deal, how much of that is holding up this economy?
See, that's a good point, Jim. That's why I was really looking at the GDP, excluding the government sector. And I think you're right. You know, what I see a lot of people talking about is the weakness in the housing market, and yet construction jobs have held up. And part of that is because of government infrastructure projects. So I think that you're right. I mean, that, and that's what's sort of striking too, you know, as we approach the debt ceiling, which Treasury Secretary Yellen says the government could run out of cash and these extraordinary means by as early as June 1st, a month away. And I think that's one of the factors that are weighing on investor sentiment and also weighing on the dollar. And I think that the, you know, yesterday the Treasury announced its anticipated borrowing needs for this quarter. And there was a big jump, bigger than the market had expected, coming from increased spending and a decline in revenue. So whatever fiscal problems you think the U.S. may have, they're not getting any better.
So, Mark, given the nature of this, what would you be doing as an investor here?
Yeah, this is a tough question. The stock market scares me, especially if you think we're headed for recession. So I'll tell you, you know, for the first time in my life, seeing how low of interest rate I was getting from the banks, and, you know, it's funny that you can see what the large banks have done. It's very much what other, like what other corporates have done. Many of the large banks reported a big jump in what they call net interest income. That's the spread they pick up between what it costs them to borrow the money and what they're lending it out at. And you think about how little they're getting in deposits, and yet they can be buying that as the banks take our deposits and buy some higher yielding security. So the first time in my life, I took my money out of my savings account and I bought a U.S. T-bill. I bought a 3-month T-bill that was yielding about 5%. And today it's yielding about 5.11. So a little bit higher than a little bit better of a yield than when I bought it at. And there's also, of course, for people who are concerned about the health of the banking system. And I think the T-bills are more liquid and there's a little bit of a tax break with them as well. So I think cash is king right now. I want to wait for the dust to settle on whether it's a debt ceiling, whether it's the economic outlook, whether it's whether the Fed pauses, what happens there. So I think cash, and I like the short end with T-bills, it gives you that flexibility. And I mean, I had previously, I think last time we talked, I mentioned the I-bond that's available for retail investors, an inflation-linked bond. But because the government is expecting inflation to fall, they've really, starting later this month when the interest gets reset, it's going to fall from about over 6% to just above 4%. So that maybe that inflation-linked bond isn't as attractive as it was in a higher inflation environment.
Yeah, I'm just looking here at T-bills, and you've got three-month T-bills at 5.27, six-month at 5.14. That, you know, Mark, I haven't seen anything like that in two decades.
I mean, we've seen this big jump here on the T-bills. Like I say, I mean, I think this is an interesting place and interesting, you know, just as far as how people can invest in themselves. You can just go to a Treasury Direct. You don't have to go to, they'll take the money right out of your account and put it back in when the T-bill matures. You don't pay a commission. You're not putting your money, you don't have to put your money in a bank or some kind of other financial institution. You can do it directly with the U.S. Treasury Department.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you, tell them how they can do so.
Sure, thanks. So I have a blog, marktomarket.com, and that is where I write for a bank and my employer, and they allow me to post my commentary on that blog, Mark to Market. I'm also active in social media. I'm on Twitter. My handle there is Mark Making Sense, and sounds like an ego type of thing, but it really comes from the title of my first book called Making Sense of the Dollar. Those are the two best places. I'm also on LinkedIn, but to follow my daily stuff, I'd say check out the blog. I have a comment up there by about 6:30 every morning. And my Twitter, I still write on Twitter, just sometimes just standalone comments about what's happening, including like today where the euro took out the 20-day moving average for the first time. Excuse me, took it out yesterday, some follow-through selling today, and it's bounced quickly back to the 110 area. And so I put a note on Twitter about dramatic price action like that.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Take care, my friend.
Thank you. Good luck to everybody.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.